This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Drew Barrymore, who we've been watching in movies since she was about six, playing one of the children in E.T. Her new role is a contrast to the romantic comedies we've come to associate her with. She's starring in Grey Gardens, the new HBO adaptation of the famous 1975 documentary Grey Gardens, which was made by the Maisels brothers. It premieres Saturday night. Grey Gardens is the story of Big Edie Bouvier Beale and her daughter, Little Edie, who were the aunt and cousin of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, but ended up living in squalor after Big Edie's husband divorced her. She refused to leave Grey Gardens, the East Hampton mansion she'd become accustomed to living in, even though her alimony wasn't nearly enough for the upkeep. Over the years, the house deteriorated until the local authorities deemed it unfit for human or animal habitation. When that story became public, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis stepped in to fund the mansion's renovation. Big Edie and Little Edie's relationship is a complex brew of love, dysfunction, delusion, and probably mental illness. In HBO's Grey Gardens, Jessica Lange plays Big Edie, Drew Barrymore is Little Edie. Here's a scene in which Big Edie and Little Edie are talking to each other and to the Maisels brothers, who are off camera filming them.
Never answers me, that woman.
Suppose I won't get out of here until she dies or I die.
Who is she, the cat?
I don't know when I'm going to get out of here.
Why do you want to get out?
Because I like freedom.
Well, you can't get it, darling. You're being supported. You can't get freedom when you're being supported.
I thought you always said you can't get freedom when you're not being supported, remember? Well, it's awful both ways, I guess. I just like a couple of days on the beach, that's all.
Well, everything's good you didn't do. At the time, you didn't want it. Everybody looks and thinks and feels differently as years go by.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. Awfully difficult.
A scene from the new HBO Grey Gardens. Drew Barrymore, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Miss Terry Gross, someone who I listen to on such a regular basis. I can't believe I have the privilege of being on your program.
Oh, thanks for saying that. That makes me feel very good. No, from what I read, you worked really hard to get cast as Little Edie. Why does the original Grey Gardens mean so much to you that you wanted to be in this dramatized version?
Well, I liked the documentary very much. I'd seen it about 8 years ago because I wanted to know what this cult phenomenon was all about. And I was very taken by it, but I sort of put it back in its DVD case and moved on with my life. And I wasn't one of the diehard fans. It was just something that really moved me and touched me, and I wanted to be educated on what the phenomenon was about. However, my friends put on headdresses and dance around and quote her and love her. And I just have always been in awe of what an impact she's had on these people's lives, how loyal they are to her, how sort of ferociously protective they are of her. So when I got the script, what I was really taken with was Michael Soucy, the writer-director, had done in sort of a very Bob Fosse-esque, unlinear, uncheesy, biopic-y way, had sort of filled in the holes of telling us and informing us how these two women got to this moment that the Maisels captured. So when I had a better understanding of their lives and I started researching them, I fell in love in a way, and as an actor, I also had never seen a project that had this level of so many challenges. First of all, she's an icon, so to imitate an icon is just very dangerous and intimidating. Then to span the age range of 18 to 58, which the film takes place for Little Edie in those years, to be able to do a voice that's so familiar, so recognizable, and yet so distinctively unique. I mean, it's got Boston, it's got New York, it's got Long Island, it's got Hamptons, it's got East Coast, it's got Southern, it's got English tones to it.
And it also has aspirations to the theater. You know,
it's very
theatrical. Like she always sees herself as being on stage, even though she's living this hermit-like existence in Grey Gardens in this mansion, this dilapidated mansion with her mother. You know, we're so used to you being in generational roles, in roles about people of your generation. And so you can use a very naturalistic voice.
Yes.
But this is completely different. She's not of your generation.
No.
And she didn't have a naturalistic voice. She had this very kind of put on voice in a way. It's a combination of regionalism and theatricality. Can you talk a little bit about what you did to get her voice in your head and in your mouth?
Well, I actually retrained my face. I studied for a year and a half with a woman named Liz Himmelstein, who's one of the most renowned vocal coaches in our industry. I spent every day, 5 days a week with her for a few hours a day training. And what I really learned to do is I wore contacts and fake teeth and 13 pieces of prosthetics to look and be like her. So I started working with the teeth, and I had them made early, and I retrained my face because I talk out of the side of my mouth and in the back of my throat, and her lips are completely forward, and everything is in the front, and she speaks very much in sort of the nose and almost like a singer. And I also did things like, you know, I studied her curriculum at all the schools she went to. I read all of her journals that she wrote.
So tell me something that you read in Little Edie's journals that made you comprehend her a little bit better or that surprised you about her.
Well, her hair loss was something that really ate her alive. When she was younger, she went through a spell of alopecia that she didn't think she was going to recover from, but she did. And she was a very beautiful young woman who was, you know, fashionable and a model and had all this potential and promise. And, you know, there's a line in the film, they did call her the Golden Girl. And, you know, she really believed her future was bright and she bought into that. And when she started losing her hair at a young age, I think this immense fear riddled her in her bones. She was obsessive about it. She wrote a lot about it. I think she also felt sorry for herself in certain ways where it was crippling to her. She was really afraid of a lot of things. And it's ironic because she's one of, like, the boldest, most quotable, entertaining characters, on the other hand, who is completely willing to expose herself and dance around the room and loves being the center of attention. But she would also hide painfully inside of herself. So, again, that stream of contradiction really for me was the thing that I kept hooking into when I tried to, you know, honor her by bringing her to life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Drew Barrymore, and she's starring in the new HBO movie Grey Gardens, which premieres Saturday night. This might be pushing things too far in terms of making kind of psychological connections, so just tell me to stop. But, you know, this is a mother-daughter story, and it's a story of, like, deep love and deep dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if part of the reason why you really wanted to play Little Edie was because of your relationship with your mother, which probably also combined love and dysfunction in pretty
yes.
large degrees. And I mean, the story of you and your mother's relationship is kind of famous, too, since you were, you know, a child star, and your father left. Your father was not in the picture by the time you were born, and your mother, you've said your mother had to work day and night in order to support you, And so she was never home and left you with babysitters. And then when you started working, you became the earner of the family as a child. So just to kind of sum up, but anyways, does the Great Garden story in some way, do you relate to some of that love-dysfunction?
I can always, you know, for myself, I've always brought my own emotions and experience, whether that be pain or joy, to the characters that I play. And this was unique because the anguish that I feel over the relationship with my own mother is incredibly intense. But her and I really decided that our dysfunction was something that needed us to part ways, and we actually haven't really been in each other's lives for many years now. So it was interesting for me because there are elements and moments of emotions that I could bring, that I could relate to, identify, and bring from a real true place in my heart about a mother-daughter relationship. But my own story has been now written quite differently than the Beals, which is that my mother and I decided to part ways, and the Beals turned off the world, isolated themselves, and are each other's salvations and partners. I also don't relate to someone who's isolated because I'm a very social person who has created my own family via a tremendously wonderful group of friends. So there was a new thing that I had to challenge myself with, which was not only this level of technique and acting and vocal coaching and, you know, etiquette lessons and learning her curriculum and reading her journals and understanding who this person was and learning perfect imitation and figuring out exactly how many breaths she would take in her famous speeches so that I could hit every single word as perfectly as I possibly could. What I did was I shut the world out when I made this film. I turned off my phone, my computer. I didn't read a newspaper, a magazine, watch television, radio, drive a car, or do anything with the outside world, including I told all the people who, like I said, are my family, that I can't speak to for 3 months because I really wanted to understand what it was like to lose everything and be isolated and be on that island. And it was one of the most painful experiences of my life. But I thought the only way that I can bring honesty and relatability to this woman is to go into a monastery of Edie Beall.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Drew Barrymore, and she's starring in the new HBO movie Grey Gardens, which premieres Saturday night. Little Edie always wanted a stage. So she didn't have one until after her mother died. When she became, as a result of the documentary, she was able to become something of a performer. But she always wanted a stage, but the only stage she had was like the world. And since she didn't mostly live in the world, she just lived in her home. It was a really teeny tiny little stage until the Maisel brothers came along and made the documentary. But you always had a stage. I mean, you were, I think, like in a dog food commercial when you were 11 months old. You were in E.T. before you were 7. So it's another way in which you're completely the opposite of her.
Yes.
What was it like to have that stage before you even understood what is a stage was?
Well, I think that's why I had to give it all up in order to understand her and to be her, because it is a totally different mentality. I'm the opposite of isolated. I am completely exposed, and it's surreal at times. It's very liberating at times. I feel like the norm of, you know, the cheers of, like, the world. I walk in and everyone's like, Norm! And I mean, it's a funny way to live. I feel like I could hitchhike across the country and get from one end to the other just by sheer, you know, hey, we've all known each other our whole lives. Like, there's sort of a natural, friendly vibe that comes with that. It's very, very surreal and very, very wonderful, too. It's such a privilege and such a gift that I never abused.
How did you know that you liked acting when you were a child? I mean, you obviously were good at it right from the start.
Thank you.
And we could certainly see that in E.T., even if we didn't see the things that you did before that. But did you like it? Did you know as a child, yeah, this is for me?
Well, there were two things. One is I cosmically and magnetically with all of the blood running through my veins, felt this connection to this family that I was born into, the Barrymores. I felt a real, honest to goodness desire to act. I felt it because they instilled it in my soul. And I never wanted to deny myself of that. In fact, I was very proud and excited of the fact that at such a young age that I was in tune and in touch with that connection with them, and wanted to honor them and play in their field and keep their name going and be like them. I admired them.
Your father, John Barrymore Jr., left. I mean, he wasn't part of the picture when you were growing up, and you never really spent a lot of time with him. How close were you with other members of the Barrymore family?
Not close at all, because they mostly were deceased before I was born. And but I would read their books and I would watch their movies, and I saw my face in their faces. Unlike other families who aren't close, I have a wealth of trunks and trunks and trunks of research material. You know, there's a great book called Minutes of the Last Meeting, written by Jean Fowler, who also wrote Goodnight, Sweet Prince. And just the adventures that he writes about with, you know, Sadakichi Hartman and John Decker and W.C. Fields and my grandfather, and the escapades that these gentlemen went on, their mentality, their zest for life. You know, I can get lost in that and understand more profoundly who I'm connected to, who I'm born from. And the reason that I love acting is because of them, and because I feel it in my blood that this is what I need to do. This is my creative, cathartic outlet. And if I didn't have it, I'd be in a straitjacket, I'm pretty sure. And on the other level, there's another kind of tribe, which is that when you don't have a family, such as I did not have a family growing up, when I went on film sets, there are these amazing, eclectic, interesting groups of people who are like the Island of Lost Toys, a band of misfits, and their little families in themselves. And when I did E.T., that really changed my life, because I'd really just done TV movies and commercials, so I never really had an experience as profound. And I also met my godfather there, Steven Spielberg, and he was a gift to me, a real father figure. And he showed me and gave me a sense of safety and inspiration and security and someone to look up to like I had never had in my life.
Well, why don't we play a clip here from E.T.?
Okay.
And this is a scene where, you know, you have seen E.T. for the first time, and you've just been, like, screaming in like, shock. And so now you're asking your brother questions about E.T., because you were initially, like, shocked and kind of afraid, and now you're really confused. So here's the scene.
Is he a boy or a girl? He's a boy. Was he wearing any clothes?
No. But look, you can't tell. Not even Mom.
Why not?
Because grown-ups can't see him. Only little kids can see him.
Give me a break.
That's Drew Barrymore in a scene from E.T. What did Steven Spielberg do to guide you through this movie?
He, he encouraged my imagination. I loved that forever, as long as I can remember, I've loved comedy. I love to make people laugh. I love when people make me laugh or something's funny. I love that he encouraged me to improv and be playful. And a lot of that is in the movie. I mean, my character in that movie is a bit of a wisecracker. I mean, she really is. So I loved that he brought out that sense of humor and sense of play in me. And then I loved how nurturing he was when we did the emotional scenes, and how kind and gentle he was. He just sent me a picture of us from doing an emotional scene, and he has his hand on the Panavision camera, and I'm crying in his arms. And it's we were doing the scene where E.T. is dying, and, not many directors are that nurturing when you have an emotional scene. And then personally, you know, he would show me movies. He introduced, you know, old cinema to me. We would have food fights in the commissary during lunch. He gave me a sense of hope and humanity because I really was a little bit scared and lost as a kid because I didn't have that guidance. And he was the person who sort of made me feel like everything's going to be okay.
Did he stay in touch with you after the movie, or did you feel like somebody else from my family abandoned me?
No, quite the opposite. Him and I have remained close. In fact, I just showed him a rough cut of the first film I directed called Whip It, starring Ellen Page. I've worked on it for the last 2 years. And I took it to him, and we watched it in his old movie theater, and he gave me notes on it, and we talked, you know, scrupulously for hours at length about it. And he's very much still a part of my life, and it's just a relationship that I will forever, till the day I die, value.
Now, I want to play a clip from another film that you're famous for from earlier in your career, and this is Scream. This is one of the classic, contemporary horror films, Wes Craven. And the opening scene, which I think is by far the best part of the film, is like the scene you're in. You get killed in the opening scene.
Yes.
And most of our listeners will know this scene, but for those who don't, you're alone at home. The phone rings. And it's somebody who appears to be a wrong number or something. And then it becomes clear that he's threatening you and that he can see you. You think you're alone, but he's close enough so that he can see you. And then he's threatening you that if you don't play ball with him, he's going to kill you. And then you realize that he's tied up your boyfriend on the front porch, and your boyfriend's sitting there bound and bleeding. And then this, like, terrifying caller starts to play this game with you. He knows you're a horror movie fan. He starts to play this game, and everything is on the line.
Yes.
Here's how we play. I ask a question. If you get it right, Steve lives.
Please don't do this.
Come on, it'll be fun.
Please.
It's an easy category.
Please.
Movie trivia. Or even give you a warm-up question.
Don't do this, I can't.
Name the killer in Halloween.
No.
Come on, it's your favorite scary movie, remember? He had a white mask, he stalked the babysitters.
No.
Come on, yes you
no.
do.
Please.
What's his name?
I can't.
Steve's counting on you.
Michael.
Yes! Very good. Now for the real question.
No!
But you're doing so well. We can't stop now.
Stop, leave us alone.
Then answer the question. Same category.
Oh, please stop.
Name the killer in Friday the 13th.
Jason!
I'm sorry. That's the wrong answer.
No, it's not. It was Jason.
Afraid not.
Way. Listen, it was Jason. I saw that movie 20 goddamn times.
Then you should know Jason's mother, Mrs. Voorhees, was the original killer. Jason didn't show up until the sequel. I'm afraid that was a wrong answer. Lucky for you, there's a bonus round. But poor Steve, I'm afraid he's out.
That's such a great scene. That's like my fear come true that there's going to be like a real life game show and you're going to get the answer wrong.
Oh, it's just terrifying. I really wanted to do that movie. I just started my company, Flower Films, and we sort of unofficially produced it. And I teamed up with Harvey Weinstein.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and we went and we found the director together, and we asked Wes to do it. And I said, you know, let's ask the man who has every 10 years created some of the most important films of that genre. And after speaking with him, I just knew he had the right take on it. And I was originally supposed to play another character, but I wanted to play that character because it was my favorite scene in the movie. And I said, the problem with scary movies is that you always know the main character is going to make it. So it's like this, you know, screwy mind game, but she always survives. So if I bite it in the first scene, all bets are off. That means anyone can get it. That's scary. That's like flipping the genre on its head. And I just got this wild idea one night in my apartment sitting alone in New York, and I called Harvey on the phone and I was like, I've got it. I was like, I've got to play this girl. And we sort of said, let's do like a Janet Leigh in Psycho.
Right, right.
And pull the rug out from under people and nobody's safe. And it was just so much fun to do. And the reason I wanted to do that on an acting level was because that scene took a week to shoot. And I've never, ever, ever had to cry that much and be hyperventilating and fear-ridden and on the verge of like passing out because of, you know, lack of breath and fear and anxiety and tears and hysteria. And to be in that state for 5 days was a total blast. It was wild.
Now, are you as big a horror movie fan as your character in Scream?
No, the opposite. I'm terrified of scary movies. Like, I don't want anything to do with them, ironically. I don't go see them. I'm absolutely terrified of them, but I wanted the acting challenge of, you know, having to get to that level of fear and tears and, you know.
Okay, so if you're so scared by horror films, what was it like to watch you as the person in Jeopardy?
I didn't mind it because I knew the tricks. You know, I was there shooting it. I knew there was a camera. I knew there was a crew. So I was okay. But I weirdly can't suspend that disbelief when I see other scary movies.
Right.
They just scare me.
You're such an interesting mix of, on the one hand, coming from this like, pedigree, this like famous family, and on the other hand, feeling like you didn't have a family because your father wasn't with you, your mother was working a lot and not with you, and became your manager for a while. But as you said before, you and she officially parted ways. And I guess it's such a kind of inherent contradiction of your life that you're part of this like really famous tribe, perhaps the most famous acting family in American history, and at the same time, you feel like you grew up without a family.
Yeah, it's like I said, we're dealt the cards we're dealt with in life, and it's up to us on how we want to play them. And I feel anything less than sorry for myself. What I'd really like to do is to keep their name alive and well and honor them. And, you know, when I go to the Chinese theater in Hollywood, which is where I try to have most of my premieres, my grandfather's face is in the cement. He put his profile because he was known as the Great Profile. And my star is actually, you know, 10 feet away from his. And here is a place at another time he was, and here I am now. And I want to keep that tradition alive.
Of your family's movies, which made the biggest impression on you?
Well, different ones for various reasons. But I love 20th Century because I think my grandfather is just funny and genius as that mad director. He's just wonderful in it. But when I watch A Bill of Divorcement with Katharine Hepburn, I get so emotional because it's about a father and a daughter reconciling. And I picture myself in her shoes and me getting to have these conversations and moments with him the way that she got to have them with him in that movie. And so that one's very personal for me. I love Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I loved that he used very little prosthetics and makeup and took the risk of acting out those physical differences between the characters. I mean, sure, he had some hair and some nails, but really it was his – he trusted his own facial features and body language. He's definitely the one I'm the most connected to and feel this deep longing for. I love Lionel in It's a Wonderful Life. Potter is one of the, you know, greatest characters. ever created, and I can't believe that's my uncle.
I know.
It's
he said
amazing.
He's such like the mean banker.
I know. And he's awesome, and he was in a wheelchair at the time. So
for real.
For real.
Yeah.
So he performed it in a wheelchair. And I love them. I love watching them.
Did having them as your family send you back to lots of other early movies too?
Yeah, I grew up watching the classics, and I still keep Turner Classic Movies on my television at all times. So I'm always watching old movies, coming home to old movies. And a lot of the times my family's on TV, and it just feels like this welcoming home, this warm fireplace of good vibes. And I have their pictures all over the wall, and it's not an obsessive thing. It's just like, you know, I'm connected to these people, and that connection makes me feel good. So I always love when I come home and I'm like, hey, guys, how are you? You're on the TV. It's a sign. I absolutely love. And it's interesting because one of my favorite love stories growing up was Captain's Courageous, which is actually a film Lionel is in as well. And Spencer Tracy and Freddie Bartholomew have this incredible relationship that evolves into something very deep and meaningful and life-changing for both of them. And the reason I fell in love with Grey Gardens is because I've always loved unorthodox love stories that don't have a sexual connotation to them, that it's about love. And I was raised on those movies as a kid, and they were more ubiquitous in the old-fashioned classics a little bit more than they are now today. Paper Moon by Peter Bogdanovich, even Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a phenomenal love story, and funny and heartwarming. And so I've always been a fan of that type of film.
People who have come from troubled families or, you know, families that broke apart like yours, I think a lot of them tend to want to have a family and make it a more better family, make it the kind of family that they wish they had and they didn't, or to not have a family because family has such like bad memories for them. Where do you fit on that scale if you don't mind answering it, if it's not too personal?
Not at all. I am definitely for option A. I believe that I'm going to be a great mother. I cannot wait to have a family. I'm so looking forward to all the challenges that I've taken on in my life. I can't wait to take on the one that shall be my greatest and most selfless if I am so lucky to have the opportunity to have a child. And I know that I will provide the exact family that I would have always wanted. And I do think that you can take damage and pain and dysfunction and use it as a blueprint of what not to do.
So I guess one of the things you wouldn't be doing is what your mother did with you, take you to Studio 54, you know, with like the big club where a lot of people are doing cocaine back when you were still a child.
Yeah, it seems irresponsible, and I don't want people to hate her for doing that because, you know, it's not the orthodox way of motherhood. On the other hand, selfishly, from my own experience, I can't believe I got to party in that heyday and be a part of a cultural phenomenon. And I'm glad because she inadvertently gave me the opportunities that I needed to have the career and the life and the job that I wanted. So, you know, trial by fire. But I hope people will forgive her for something like that because I don't believe she did them with malcontent intentions. I think she just, you know, was a bit of a kid herself. And, you know, I got where I was. I got that I was at Studio 54, and I was like, you know what? I'm glad I got to be in this moment. And, you know, I saw a lot of amazing things growing up. Maybe they weren't for children to see, but that was my life, and I have no regrets. It's what's formed me.
Well, Drew Barrymore, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I'm so honored to be on your program. I'm not kidding. I listen to you all the time. I just can't believe I'm not like in my Crown Vic driving down the road listening to this myself. I don't believe it's really happening. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Drew Barrymore stars in the new HBO adaptation of Grey Gardens, which premieres Saturday night. Kelly Clarkson was the first person to take the top prize on American Idol. Since that time, she's had a number of big hits. Now she's back with a new album called All I Ever Wanted. And rock critic Ken Tucker says, what Clarkson seems to want are hits on her own terms.
Kelly Clarkson's big, assertive voice was what won her American Idol's top prize, but she's done a lot of work tinkering with her music and her image. She's alternately embraced her instant pop stardom, rejected it, subverted it, and poked fun at it. All I Ever Wanted is easily her most enjoyable album to date because she does all these things at one point or another on it. Take the song that led off this review called I Do Not Hook Up, and especially the album's unstoppable hit single, My Life Would Suck Without You.
Yes, this means you're sorry.
Now that's a single with everything going for it. A little guitar riff that gets absorbed into an electronic rhythm section, only to be overwhelmed by Clarkson's swelling vocal. The result is a rock, disco, pop creation that just builds and builds until it explodes in its chorus. This is the way Clarkson first distinguished herself from her American Idol roots, when her 2004 hit, Since You've Been Gone, demonstrated that she didn't have to oversing or rely on pointless displays of melismatics to deliver a song effectively. It's a style she's honed well. This album arrives with a backstory. Her first record was a collaboration with lots of seasoned songwriters and producers who supplied her with power ballads galore, some of them excellent, some of them hideous, all of it commercially successful. Feeling her oats, she rebelled, ditching the people who'd given her her first hits and writing a lot of I'm a Rebel, I'm in Pain songs herself. That album tanked. And so this album, All I Ever Wanted, is seen as the great compromise, the comeback, the hard-won lesson. As she sings on the title song, all I ever wanted was a simple way to get over you. That is, in a career context, a way to get past the idea that pleasing the public and pleasing herself were mutually exclusive notions.
Tear up the photographs where yesterday won't let go. Every day, every minute, here comes the emptiness. Just can't leave lonely. It's time you let me know.
Clarkson constantly finds ways to hymn the travails of ordinary people, in which group she includes herself. She knows that the anguish she likes to sing about is enjoyed by millions of people as grandiose admissions of vulnerability. Yet the music that delivers that message is anything but vulnerable. There's a reason they call them power ballads. A sad song blasted at full volume is a metaphor for finding strength in pain. Kelly Clarkson is unique among American Idol graduates in that she doesn't appear in the gossip columns, and her image, something the TV show is designed to cultivate as much as it does music, she's kept that deliberately fuzzy. What this means for her music is that she's still not locked into one style or one mood. For a manufactured pop star, she's achieved an impressive amount of creative freedom. Her pain is our pleasure, and you get the idea that that's just the way she wants it to be.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Kelly Clarkson's new CD, All I Ever Wanted. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to the different words people use to describe Bernard Madoff and the other financial miscreants in the news. Some of the words are old, like scoundrel. Some are new, like sociopath. And some are, well, a little blue. He has these thoughts about the changes in our moral vocabulary.
After it came out that Elie Wiesel had lost his life savings and most of the assets of his foundation to Bernard Madoff, somebody asked him if he thought Madoff was a psychopath. "Psychopath is too nice a word for him," Wiesel answered. "Sociopath, psychopath, it means there's a sickness, a pathology. I'd simply call him thief, scoundrel." Scoundrel, that's a word you'd expect to hear from Wiesel, whom people look to as an emissary from a more absolute old-world moral order. In fact, it's the very word Dickens used to describe a character who eerily foreshadows Madoff right down to his name. Mr. Myrtle is the unscrupulous banker in Little Dorrit, probably the darkest of Dickens' novels, which by pure serendipity has been running on PBS in a BBC adaptation. Despite his obscure origins and awkward manner, Myrtle is lionized by people of fashion who jostle to invest with him until his suicide reveals that he was a swindler who left everyone who trusted in him destitute. As Dickens described it, old people who had been in easy circumstances all their lives would have no place of repentance for their trust in him but the workhouse. Legions of women and children would have their whole future desolated by the hand of this mighty scoundrel. Scoundrel and the like don't have that Dickensian rumble anymore. The problem isn't that we've rejected Victorian morality, but that we've rejected the class system that it rested on. Scoundrel, wretch, knave, rogue, bounder, cad, just about every word in the Victorian moral vocabulary originated as a name for the lowborn or for vagabonds or menials or the like, and each of them implied a specific deficiency of breeding. When somebody asked Myrtle's Jeeves-like chief butler after the suicide why he wasn't surprised to learn of his master's behavior, he answers, "Sir, Mr. Myrtle never was the gentleman." It's true that scoundrel hasn't gone quite the way of wretch or bounder. People still use the word when they want to suggest high-collared Victorian rectitude. That's presumably what Lillian Hellman was reaching for when she used Scoundrel Time as the title of her 1976 memoir, The McCarthy Years. But unless you're Elie Wiesel, it's hard to use scoundrel in earnest without coming off as starchy or superior. Mostly, the word is just jocular now. You think of the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin and Michael Caine playing rival con men on the Riviera. You knew from the title alone that it was a comedy. We'd have a different take on the movie if it had been called Dirty Rotten Sociopaths. That's not a word we use affectionately. It's reserved for unsympathetic malefactors, particularly when they operate at a Madoffian scale. We tend not to waste it on small-time crooks and grifters. This isn't the kind of clinical language that Wiesel was alluding to, which exonerates badness by reframing it as illness. That's the phenomenon that sociologists call the medicalization of deviance, and that Stephen Sondheim described crisply in G. Officer Krupke, "I'm depraved on account of I'm deprived." Nowadays, sociopath has become a loose term of abuse for anybody you want to claim as unfettered by the pangs of conscience. No major political figure has escaped the label, from Obama and both Clintons to George W. Bush and Newt Gingrich. You even see people calling Dick Cheney a sociopath. I say even because most of the lists of diagnostic criteria for the label start with superficially charming. When it comes to the crunch, sociopath doesn't add anything to what the Victorians expressed as heartless wretch. Except that now the moral judgment comes draped in a white coat. It purports to be the kind of objective scientific classification that confers the authority to police and punish in the modern world. You can't suspend a kid from school nowadays just for being unruly or obstreperous. You need a diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder. And you can't put somebody away just for being a scoundrel. Of course, we still have words to describe those derelictions in purely moral terms, but most of them are colloquial or vulgar. The tabloid New York Post had its writers calling Madoff Bernie the Bum, evoking the front stoop language of guys from the old neighborhood. Donald Trump called him a sleazebag, and others compared him to a heaping quantity of ordure. And a number of people called him a scumbag. Mad Magazine even ran a spoof poster for a movie about Madoff called Scumbag Billionaire. As it happens, that's the word Bill Clinton used during the campaign last year to describe the author of an unflattering article about him in Vanity Fair. The next day, he had a spokesman apologize for his language as inappropriate. But that's exactly what makes this language effective when you want to manifest genuine indignation. It proves that your anger is strong enough to burst through the normal restraints. I certainly wouldn't wax elegiac about words like scoundrel and wretch, not with the baggage they carried. But it's odd that we have to step outside of the language of public life when we want to express authentic indignation or forcefully reprehend somebody simply for being bad. Which, while I'm at it, is another word that Dickens took a lot more seriously than we do.
Jeff Nunberg teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously, will be published next month. I'm Terry Gross.